This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. Fabrice, welcome to This Restorative Justice Life. Who are you?
I am Haitian. Black Haitian, born in the first independent Black nation in the planet.
Who are you?
I am a visionary. I think in ideas, and I believe that our planet will be saved by creativity.
Who are you?
I'm American. I'm an immigrant to the U.S., and I believe that the power in America is really this idea of different multicultural identities and perspective being able to live in one space. And I think that's the seedling of the deep future of our collective planet.
Who are you?
I'm a human being. I'm imperfect. I'm shattered. I'm broken. I have traumas inside of me. And I have to learn to accept them. And I have to learn to embrace them. Because I know that they're going to create that level of empathy that is necessary for change.
Who are you?
I am a writer. I dance with words. I create meaning with words. I use my activism with words, my leadership with words. And I create imaginary fictional worlds, science fiction and fantasy worlds through my writing.
Who are you?
I am a brother and I'm a son. I'm part of my family and I love them very dearly.
And finally, who are you?
I'm an entrepreneur. I think entrepreneurship tends to get a bad rap, but I do feel like entrepreneurship is like, how do you connect people and build community? How do you embrace relationships and you're able to connect other people from different walks of life to create something new that hasn't existed before?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being here. We're going to get to all those intersections of who you are and your work right after this.
Hey folks, I'm Elise, your producer, and today we are welcoming Fabrice Guerrier to the show today. Fabrice is a Haitian American entrepreneur, a science fiction and fantasy writer, as well as a columnist at the Haiti Observatoire. He has founded the sci-fi and fantasy production companies for writers and creatives called Syllable. He is a great creative, and he also hosts a podcast and is a music artist as well, which you can check out in the show notes below. In this episode, Fabrice shares his experiences in using restorative practices in the creative fields in order to create a better world. Without further ado, let's get back into it.
Welcome back. It is so good to have you, Fabrice. Typically at this point, I say like it's always good to check in. So to the fullest extent to the question that you want to answer, how are you? But that's not what I'm going to say. Right now I'm going to say, sak passe.
Ah, okay. Form, na boule. I'm doing good, I think. The thing I always say is that I love this topic around restorative justice because restoring processes that idea has been so fundamental to my life because I always say like I being a Black person in this country, I'm in deep pain and constant motion. I'm always in pain and I'm always suffering, but I feel like it is up to me to be able to not only use that pain but also engage my mental health in such a way that's conducive. So I think I ran earlier today. I haven't meditated today. I've journaled this morning. Doing all the self-care things that I need to do to be vibrant and be present and to restore sort of my sanity in this planet, I think is so fundamental. So I think I'm doing well, despite all of the challenges and the wombs of this planet.
Yeah. That hit me deep. And for the audience, we're recording this on February 8th, on February 3, the night of February 3, right? Amir Locke was murdered in his house, sleeping, no knock warrant. I'm sure you've heard the story. And, you know, I don't have great morning habits, but, you know, the first thing I do, like, open my phone on the morning of the 4th, open Twitter, and it's like, another fucking hashtag, right? Another Black life lost. And since then, now that you like just said this, like as a Black person navigating the world, like there's always pain. There's always pain. And I'm thinking about, you know, I did work out on Saturday, but like today's Tuesday, yesterday was Monday. Like I couldn't get myself out of bed to do those things. Like it's just like the weariness of this other thing. Like, you know, on some level, yeah, we do have to move, but like it's important to take that space to acknowledge the pain and grieve. And you know, I'm doing that live on the air for myself right now in some ways, but yeah, in all of that, I am hopeful, right? Because of conversations like you and I are about to have. Like I told you before we started recording, I'm very, very excited because of all the ways that I think art and creativity can lead us towards a better world. But thank you for bringing that all up and helping me check in as well. You know, we always ask our guests, and you kind of brought it up from the beginning, like, you know, before you knew the words restorative justice, restorative ways of being were a part of your life. From your own perspective, how did that get started for you?
This is such a powerful and deep question.
Yeah.
So like being born and raised in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, I think as a post-colonial country that's sort of born out of slavery, born out of their freedoms and many different types of intergenerational cultural trauma that's passed down in terms of Westernization or democratization, or even the dictatorship with Duvalier. I think all of those things were really steeped inside of me. And when I moved to the US, I think the way that I sort of perceived the world was through that post-colonial lens. And I think a post-colonial lens is very essential in terms of how do we create the world and make it a better place. But I also feel it has a lot of limitations because for me, my journey to restorative justice was sort of opening this sort of treasure's chest inside myself and seeing aspects of myself that I didn't know even existed. And a lot of them were very much like traumas and pain and suffering and doubt. And me coming to the US and seeing those sort of two dimension, my Haitian self, my American self forming just by being here and trying to kind of pull myself up in such a way. I think the best metaphor I remember, so I studied conflict transformation at the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at EMU. And one of the metaphors that I believe it was Barry Hart, I took a trauma healing class with him. He's one of the trauma healing scholars. And he talked about how trauma is almost like a rock that is jabbed into a tree, forced into a tree. And as the tree grows, this rock becomes part of the tree. And if you try to remove that rock, that tree will collapse and it will fall and it will die. And it's almost as if this rock now inhabits part of who you are and who I am. And I think for me, restorative justice sort of gave me the language and the structure to really think outside of a Western way of thinking of like logic or historicizing things or economizing things in terms of my value and my ideas. Restorative justice sort of pulled back the layer of sort of an essence that was already in me and how that essence had layers and dimensions. And I think for me, my journey into restorative justice is almost sort of healing those aspects of myself in a way that allows me to be in right relationship with not only other people, my community, my country, the world, this planet, the cosmos. It's almost as if it's nested in those things. So I think The journey is not, I have not arrived in the journey. I don't think anyone can arrive. Maybe they can, but I have not arrived. I think I notice this sort of longitudinal change that is possible based on what I am and what I've undergone. So it's definitely created a deeper level of empathy as well as I engage my day-to-day, because I know everyone is going through their own paths and their own journeys. So I think a lot of it, yeah, definitely just kind of meeting myself for the first time or many times, and then understanding who I am from like a healing perspective.
Yeah, not everyone who has experienced the trauma that you've experienced, right, growing up in Port-au-Prince, the immigration, and you can share some of the specifics if you'd like to, but not everyone who goes through that kind of trauma looks at it through a lens of how can I heal, how can I have empathy for others who are causing me harm, and empathy for myself as I am, trying to grow like a tree. With this rock in place, what were some of the influences for you that helped you think that way?
Absolutely. I was just looking up the root word for trauma, and it comes from a word, it literally means wound, W-O-U-N-D. So like a scar. I think a lot of it is just like, it's just, I always believe an aspect of the future is like biomimetic. So it's just looking at nature, the natural world, looking at the natural world and how the natural world functions. And it's like you have, when you get a cut, a small paper cut, or you fall on the floor and they're like, you're in a park or you're playing soccer or basketball, and you get, I think a lot of these, the way that the wounds heal, it's like you have to tender to it and it takes time to close. And you might have some scars as well, where that part of the skin might still be this and it could get infected. So I think for me, looking at just sort of like how a physical wound is and what does that translate to a psychological or emotional or spiritual historical wounds, and how these things sort of are tied so deeply to our identity. So I felt like I had wounds, I had scars, and those things were just not by my own volition, but by just the way the world is currently designed, the way it's modeled, the way that we talk about different aspects of the world, and the way that we start to have sort of certain narratives around why things are, what is possible, what's not possible, limitations, or who we hate and why we hate them, and what's good and what's bad, this sort of duality of the world and how it's expressed from a very, just like it came from a single prototype of like the white Western man. And it's like trying to apply this entire way of thinking to the entire world, I think creates a lot of harm. So I think, I don't know if that makes any sense, but I feel like for me, just looking at the natural world, looking how these patterns can also apply to our own psychological landscape, and really just kind of taking the time to reflect and think and just ruminate on a lot of these things and create space for the right circumstances to rise in me.
Yeah. Was there a specific, like you talked about, you know, just healing of wounds, like as something that we can observe in the natural world. Maybe it's that, maybe it's another thing that you saw that you were able to apply, that you were able to apply to your life and your context as you were growing up. And, you know, for some reason saying like, oh, it's worth my time to continue to learn more about this healing, this conflict transformation, this quote unquote restorative justice way of being.
This is sort of this Rumi quote or Hafiz quote that says like, first I wanted to change the world, and then I realized I needed to change myself. I internalized that so much to the point where I'm like, I felt like the more that I healed myself, or the more that I came to terms with certain like parts of myself, my history, or what it means to be Haitian, or even like the imperial legacy of like US engagement in Latin America. And what does that mean? Like, I remember I was working at the State Department around 2016, just to give you context. I moved there 5 weeks before, 5 or 6 or 8 weeks before Trump was inaugurated. So it definitely was an interesting space to work in that government space. But I think, even before that, I had done an internship while I was in grad school. And a lot of my sort of mindset was like, okay, the US did this. The US has like really done harm in all these different countries. It's like a massive tentacle. But like when I actually went to the building and actually met the people and actually talked to the people, got to know a lot of some of the brightest minds and people who care deeply around like creating change and human rights and all, and in all its perspectives. I think from that was almost as if it's like I was carrying this burden, this anger inside of me. And then I realized like it's not that simple in terms of like there's these broad narrative strokes of like victimhood and the broad narrative strokes of like pain or oppressor. I think it's just, I think for me, going inside myself and healing, it almost opened different thresholds of empathy. I was having a conversation with two friends this last weekend, and the whole conversation was around empathy and what does empathy mean and how can we spread empathy? And I think what I came out of this conversation was almost as if it's like there is this planetary empathy. There is this political empathy. There's this personal empathy. And I almost connected that when I first moved to the US, I wasn't connected to this planetary empathy because I was so much more into my own life and like as an immigrant, learning the language, trying to understand how to navigate this world. And I felt like as I healed, it opened me to this frequency that was already there, this sort of planetary empathy. And it's, I think you can go in on the same level in terms of personal people you meet in your day to day. So I feel like the inner work allowed me to feel more meaning. It's almost as if it's like it's like human beings are like a radio channel. Let's say there's like 10 channels of what it means to feel. And I feel like once you start to heal and you start to really apply this restorative like justice philosophy or this restorative process in one's life, you start to sort of magnify this channels that you have access to. It could be empathy, it could be imagination, it could be creativity, it could even be pain, because it's almost as if the Osho says, like, the higher the branches of happiness goes, the deeper the roots of sadness. So we're always living in this sort of duality. So I feel for me, it's just like, how do I expand my mind? And how do I expand my empathy? How do I expand my emotion, my imagination, so I can feel more and take in more pain? But it's almost as if that pain is not necessarily negative. It's almost like it's almost wisdom. So I think that expresses itself in many things, just having a voracious appetite to learn about history, voracious appetite to understand neuroplasticity. Like I have like 1,000 quotes in my wall and I read them every day. I did that bit back in grad school. And I know like reading them every day, like thinking about these poetic statement, philosophical statement, or just something that's extremely beautiful and meaningful to me, read them every day. I know that's in like 5 months, that's going to change my neural pattern. That's going to sort of make my default less reactive or just induced, because I know I need to be my best self, because I think we are at war in terms of just this decay of our current model of a society that a lot of people just realize now after COVID just doesn't work. It's just, yes, you could say it works, but it's like on the most philosophical basis, there's a lot of fallacies that a lot of people are just sort of like fed. And I think that's normal. If you want to manage 300 million people, you got to have a certain narrative and mythology to guide humanity in a certain frequency. But like with the age of the internet, with the age of technology, it's like now, like truth is sort of decentralized. Everyone has their own pockets of things. And I think we're in this stage of massive change that I feel like a lot of people are lost and a lot of people are feeling more pain. And it's like, but they might not necessarily have that restorative lens that pain is part of that journey. Pain is that rock that's jabbed into the tree that we can't remove, that we have to face it head on and deal with it, both personally and collectively.
Yeah, I think there's a ton in there, and I'm going to respond to the things that you said at the very end, right? Where it's like, yes, there's this pain, and some people's ancestors put that rock in the tree, and some people's ancestors have benefited from that rock being in the tree and not wanting to acknowledge that. And like, that's a different healing journey than people who are dealing with pain caused by white people's ancestors, European colonizer, settler, enslaver ancestors, right? There's this dehumanization of the black body, right, the indigenous body here on this continent, since we're talking about, you know, Turtle Island, the United States, I can intellectually get there with you where I'm like, yeah, those people are healing. They have this narrative that they're ascribing to, and like to deviate from that is scary and you lose that. But like the other part of me is like, no, you're just wrong and you're hurting me and you're hurting my people. And it's hard to have empathy. I was talking to Kay Prentice, just like a year and change ago. It was on January 6th. And at the time that we stopped recording the podcast, her grandson came into the room and was like, they're storming the Capitol. And even in that conversation, it was like, I don't know how much tolerance I have or like empathy that I can muster for folks who, like, I didn't even know at the time were like trying to overthrow the United States democratic process, right? I know that you've done work with Coming to the Table, which Jody talked about a couple episodes back on this podcast, but how do you get yourself into that empathetic and not angry and closed off place?
That is a powerful question. I really appreciate it. It's not easy at all because it's like microaggressions, like you just get microaggressions in every place. And it's almost as if it's like, is it my fault that I'm feeling this way? Or is this the other person's place, even if they're good intention or meaningful about it? And it's almost as if it's like anytime you start having these type of conversation, it's like my humanity is on the line.
I go in like armor up, and like I know that armor up closes me off to other people, like be in their vulnerable space where we can share and actually like have these conversations.
Absolutely. Challenges are also opportunities. For me, it's really getting to the expansive view, E-X-P-A-N-S-I-V-E, the expansive view of like what's happening. What are some of the global movements that are happening? Because I feel like poor whites and poor blacks, their destinies are inextricably tied. And I think we have a current narrative, and you can go back to Fanon on how this sort of colonial Western thought has always been, let's divide the people and let's pit them against each other. Let's create chaos. Let's have ownership on the narrative and let's manipulate these processes so people don't see those commonalities. And I think that happens, that is happening. I think that is the mainstream. And I think the challenge is, how do I come in as an individual? Knowingly so that anytime I'm gonna engage in conversation that my humanity is gonna be on the line. And like this sort of intellectual or even social like debate is like my black body is on the line and they might not know that. And it's like, I have to have the empathy to be able to know when you come down to restorative justice, which asks different sets of questions of like, you said it perfectly. What if the white ancestors came in, the white ancestors came in and like jabbed that rock into that tree. I think for me, restorative justice, if I were to really fully embody that restorative justice philosophy, it's like, how am I in the right relationship even with my enemy, even with my oppressor? Because I think going through like grad school and studying peace building and conflict transformation, the massive amount of change that happened was almost internally, because I had to do the inner work. I had to be able to be that vessel to embrace that thing. I always say that by the fact of being Haitian, I believe violence is fundamental to creating a just and socially constructive society. I believe that as my Haitian identity. But I also believe that I felt like after I graduated from my master's and like studied under Kay Prentice, you know, Carl Stauffer, Howard Zaire, Jane Doherty, all of these really phenomenal scholars and activists and people that have worked on the field, and like studying nonviolent, strategic peace building, all of these things, I always say there's a baby pacifist that was born inside of this sort of community of identity. So I am both a pacifist and Haitian at the same time. And I think those two identities for sure clash, going back to who am I? I think like those two identities clash, but I think or humanity and the direction I personally believe humanity is sort of destined to be is like I think we're all polymaths. I think we have to sort of embrace all aspects of things and learning and growth and being able to tied to so many different frequencies. I think as human beings, like we're supposed to feel more. And I think the way the world is designed, we've been muted, we've been shut out, our creativity is being closed out. The symbolic structures in our mind and our ability to imagine something outside of Western construct has been completely clamped. So for me, I feel like restorative justice as a process allows me to really sort of, how do I sit my pacifist self and my Haitian self to a table internally and start to have a conversation around why are you a pacifist? What does it mean to be Haitian? What are the value in both of these things? Where do these separations happen? I think those paradoxes, those dialectical like engagements, I think creates more humanity. But I feel like in the current way and in terms of our mythology and our narrative in the media and how race is being seen and how people are being portrayed against each other, where real harm is being done. People are being shot, people are being killed. More Black people are in jail than like kids, scooters, prison pipeline. Like this is some horrifying shit, excuse my language. But what does it mean? I think those are the questions that restorative justice like really ask us. Cause I was very challenged by that forgiveness. Like, why would I forgive someone if my life is on the line and like I've been harmed? Like, I want to hold on to that.
A restorative process doesn't inherently require forgiveness, right?
Yeah.
But like for your own healing, right? Like, what is it that you want to do? I was thinking about like the micro version of this. You know, you'll appreciate this as an entrepreneur. I went into this group on Facebook and I put out this question: what would your schooling experience have been like if people really practiced restorative justice? And as you can imagine, there were very contrasting opinions flying around and stories flying around. Things from like, you know, like, it would have done nothing. It would have made my bullying experience worse because all they do is go talk to the kids in the dean's office or like let them go play basketball, right? And, you know, I not pushed back, but I was like, well, what if we like reframe restorative justice around like accountability and support, not just like permissiveness? But there were also people in there who were talking about, you know, oh, you know, I wouldn't have been expelled from 3 schools, right? I wouldn't have ended up homeless because my parents didn't know what to do with me and kicked me out, right? And, you know, people shitting on the process because, like, you know, they're just soft on these kids. They need, quote unquote, discipline. All of our stories are rooted in, like, I want to be safe, right? I want to, in this scenario, like, be able to learn, right? I want to be in community and good relationship with everybody. Some people's idea of like what safety means is like control and order, right? Mm. So like to your point, like you can manage 300 million people. So you can manage a classroom, quote unquote, manage a classroom. Some people are like, if people had taken the time to get to know what was going on at home, things would have been better. And like, I want to shout out to the teachers, the educators who I also recognize are in a tough position where they are being incentivized not to build those relationships, not to care. And like many of you, probably those of you listening to this podcast are the ones who are making the time to do that, to get to those, you know, those root causes. And you're still like ill-equipped with like resources, finances, time to be able to like really address those problems. So like, we talk about it like on a small classroom level where, you know, you have a kid who flipped over their desk and like it hit somebody, right? Because they were angry about and irritable because they were not able to do their math homework, but that's because like of the fight that was going on in their home at night, so they weren't able to sleep or even focus on their homework. And like you can think about all the levels of like either redlining or like strategic divestment from neighborhoods, mass incarceration that affects, you know, that child's family in one way, shape, or form, and overlying patriarchy, all those systems, right? Like, it's not any one person's responsibility to fix all that for that one child, but like, can you say in that moment, like, you're not a bad person, you're going through some shit? That's hard to do when like somebody flipped over a table and like disturbed your lesson and the learning of all the other people. How much harder is it to say like, Mr. Trump had a, like, while he grew up in wealth, like, had a really tough upbringing when it comes to like his the way that he was parented and the lies that he was told about like whiteness. And like, of course, this is the way that he is trying to be in the world, maintain control, look out for himself. Like, how do we shift those narratives? And, you know, a couple weeks ago on the podcast, we had Chimdindu come on and ask me, like, you know, what are the other spaces that I want to see restorative justice happen in the world? And what I said to her is, like, in media, in storytelling, to help people imagine. That's what you do in so many different ways. While your job title is not quote unquote restorative justice practitioner, you infuse themes of restorative justice and this radical imagination into your work with Syllable. So tell us how that got started and what you're doing and the impact that you've seen it have.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And I question for you even before we move that, because I feel it could tie in very well. It's like, I guess my question to you would be, like, how do you react when you go into a space which, like, it's like antagonistic towards your own, like, mental health, your own history, your own race, or maybe someone that just doesn't get it? How do you, what happens, like, for you? Like, what is your mechanism for, like, navigating that? Do you have empathy, or is empathy a dried well?
There's two different types of, I'll say three different types of spaces. One, if I'm doing it in digital space, I know that there are limits to what people can convey on a keyboard. And so, like, I'm not trying to convince anybody on a Facebook thread or an Instagram thread. Like, in my mind, I can be like, oh, there's this misunderstanding, but, like, this is not the medium to to build that. So I kind of just shut that down. Out when I go and do work with schools, with organizations, and those things come up, one, I'm being paid. That's my job, right? It doesn't mean that, like, I don't feel the things, but it's like always about, like, hey, how do we build the space so, like, those things can be said and those things can be challenged. And so I can say, like, hey, I'm curious about what you meant by this, right? This is the impact that it had on me. Depending on the relationships that we've built in the space, however long the engagement is with that school, that company, that community, I may, like, let it slide, or I may bring it up to people after, or I might address it in the moment, depending on time, relationship, or, like, you know, you just might keep it pushing because, you know, sense of urgency, like, we've got time and we've got material that we want to cover. So let's hope that some of this sticks and you're able to reflect on it later. Out in the world, though, when that shit happens, most of the time, it's armor up, right? It's armor up and retreating, right? Because it's dangerous to engage, right? And I can be empathetic, like, inside, like, oh, that person's, like, really hurting. This person is misunderstanding. But, like, I'm also, like, I'm just trying to, like, leave this target right survive, now. Yeah. I'm not trying to, like, like, build this deep relationship and come into, like, right relationship with you. Like, so they're varying levels depending on the setting. And I think, like out in the world, like, public people that I don't have relationships with, but when things are said within family relationships or close relationships, sometimes I've challenged, like, very angrily in the moment. Like, not like, hey, I was curious, what do you mean by that? What you meant by that? It's like, what do you mean by that? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, like, that hasn't gone well. And even though I've been quote unquote right, like, what does that do to the relationship? Mm-hmm. You know? And so, like, it looks differently in every situation. Sometimes it's like, hey, let's loop back to this after the fact when, like, I'm a little bit more settled. Because, like, you know, that person that I have love for, I know that they weren't trying to hurt me. And, like, there was still impact in the way that that was framed. I also know that, like, last weekend, where it wasn't even around, like, racial dynamics or, like, power and oppression dynamics, it was just about, like, not acknowledging somebody's pain that they shared with me through text. I kind of just, like, yada yada, then, like, on to the next thing, is like, oh, wait. I've got to circle back and follow this up.
No, I think everything you say resonates with me a lot. And I've had to come to terms that those personal relationships, those personal dynamics are, like, that's where change happens the most. But you got to be very strategic about it. If it arises, because you can't pick a battle with every single person that says something that you might think is unjust or just is outright wrong because it goes against your humanity. I think humans are inherently systems thinker. And I think that's this sort of systems thinking is sort of this meta narrative, meta imagination, meta mythologies that we need to start to kind of embrace to say, okay, this, as the kids flipping the table, I will hold up that teacher to her or him or they, them, like to see that the every system that's happening. Yeah, maybe the kid's parent went to jail, or maybe the kid's suffering with like bulimia, or maybe they're in the neighborhood or something happened. Like I believe that we are able to see that system thing. But I think a lot of it is just like, that requires a lot of whole work. And for me, in my personal journey, to even tie in your question, is like, I felt like, how could I align something I'm deeply passionate about? How could I align something that I'm theoretically very curious about? And also this sort of evolution of humanity, because initially I felt like, even going through grad school, it's like in undergrad, I felt like I was very much, I wanted to work within the systems, within the governments, within the organization, within the structures. And I think that was sort of my theory of change. Is I think if I can be in the systems, I can change through policy, through processes. And I came to realize that a lot of what we're facing in terms of issues and this sort of transition that humanity, mankind is going from this sort of pre-digital, now digital world, I feel like the work that I'm being called towards is around the art, the work of art and the work of art and activism. And the organization I founded, Syllable, is a production house, a science fiction and fantasy production house, and where we bring our creators together, writers, visual artists together, to really imagine new fictional worlds that have never existed before. They could be close to reality, or they could be in a completely new different planet, or it could have a different metaphysics. I was listening to a conversation with Umberto Eco last week, and he talked about this idea of the cosmological construction. I personally believe, for me, the work that I'm doing in terms of like restoring sort of the imaginations, I think our collective imagination is colonized. And we are, again, in that those like 10, we're like being pushed and forced to be in those 10 frequencies in that inner radio that I had the metaphor that I'm using. And I feel like those frequencies are deeply tied to an economy. They're deeply tied to a political thought. They're deeply tied to a history, and they're deeply tied to how our systems are incentivized. And for me, when I look out in the world, I get really saddened because I feel our imagination is like, there is so much potential in terms of imagining radical things and radical ideas and radical realities that can inspire. So the way that shows up in Syllable is like, for example, I gathered two Black Caribbean writers, and we met over a period of a few months, and we designed the Caribbean Sky Islands world. That's one of our worlds. We have many worlds in Syllable. And a lot of it was, how could we imagine a sort of world where Black people and Black and brown people could thrive? And it's a science fantasy world where all the Caribbean islands rise up into the sky 8 to 6 times a year, either for carnival or escaping like rising sea levels and hurricanes. And it's, we created a new pantheon of God. We creating a, like there is, I didn't come up with this, but there is a part of the world where now males are lactating now, whenever they're dating, like, or maybe they're married. It's based on free love, but they're in a relationship partnership with a woman, and the woman has a baby. The male starts to lactate and gets to take care of the baby. Now, where that process is not on the mother to be like the sort of the bread.
The only person.
Yeah, the only person. And they do this to like tonics, like sort of like lotion, like potions and plants and things. So there's a lot of magical realism. There's a lot of magic, fantasy, and science in it too. And then each of us wrote 3 stories. So that's the model, is like, we get creators together, imagine a new world. And then we bring those creators and that world to start to play and to start to create short stories. Because I think in terms of just the mythology structure of a writer is that you're supposed to be in your cave. You're supposed to be in your, you're supposed to be in your room by yourself writing these great works of fiction. But I started to realize, and I'm like, this is the digital age right now. And why is this like classical way of writing still stuck in this classical way of thinking? And I think collaboration sort of met a lot of the pain points I had felt as a writer, like loneliness, not understanding the industry, being held accountable for my writing. So this community really was born out of a vision to like bring a new paradigm. It happens in Hollywood, like where there's the writer's room. But a lot of the worlds in Hollywood, like the Star Wars or the Lord of the Rings or all these big films and games are locked up in the studios. And it's like, you don't have access to write. Yes, there's fan fiction, but this was sort of a way to, how do we help writers to construct a universe and design a world and create a new mythology, a new canon? Because I think the work that we're, in terms of how it relates to restorative justice, I think it's like, how can we start to innovate our current mythologies and our narratives and how we sort of accept the way things are based from like a philosopher or some white writer from in like Europe in like the 1800s said that this logical thing was good, and they wrote like 300 pages. It's like, how can we start to kind of center our imagination and local rooted practices? So like another project we had, we partnered with the State Department where they assisted us in bringing authors from Australia, New Zealand, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and Alaska, and they're writing in the world in 2060. And they've been meeting with people in the Brain Trust that are sort of like academics, sort of look at the research of what's happening on our planet, like climate change or lack of resources, poverty, health, and how could they write intentionally to imagine in 2060 and the world that they created, what these patterns and these solutions or these processes could look like in that process. So I think for me, a lot of the next stage, me being in LA now, is like tying Syllable to the broader ecosystem and trying to get more creators, more writers to write and connect.
Yeah. One of the things that's on my mind is like, oh, I need to introduce you to Gilbert Salazar, who just helped produce a short film about white fragility and the experience of women of color restorative justice practitioners with white fragility. And so it's like, oh, man, just people, stories, all of those things. And that's just like a subtle callback to the episode that we had a couple of weeks ago, right? But when I think about all of this, there are two things. One, like fiction as this imaginative, restorative space to really to heal. I love what you said. Like, you know, our collective imagination is colonized so much to the point where, you know, in Black Panther, this this watershed moment for like Black Hollywood, right? The end of that story was, we let the person who was causing all the quote-unquote harm, Killmonger, die instead of restoring that relationship. And then we start a science center in Oakland, right? like, what is that? Mm. Like, what is the future that we can imagine? Like, you know, no shade for real at Ryan Coogler and all the creatives and the imaginative work that happened to, you know, put that together. But, like, is that really what we're... like limiting Black excellence to, right? Like what is the thing that we can transcend and go beyond? Like for me, you know, when Killmonger says like, you know, bury me in the sea with my ancestors, cause it's better to die than to be locked up. Like, do you really think that they had jails in Wakanda? Do you think they had a prison system that replicates like what was in the US and Wakanda? No, bro, like you're gonna heal. And like, what would that have looked like? And so there's so many places that I love to imagine. But the other thing that gets in the way of that, I think, you know, like part of it is like, you know, our imaginations are limited because of like the stories that we've been told and the gatekeepers who gets to tell who those stories, which stories get greenlit, which stories get produced. And, you know, it's beautiful that like things are decentralized now and people have so many more avenues to like put these things out. The other thing that I think about though is that like even for myself, as someone who would love to like participate in all of this, like just so busy, to engage in that kind of imagination is just another level of energy that capitalism doesn't allow us to even like imagine that we have the ability to do, right? I'm reflective of something that I saw on Instagram, Twitter, one of them, right, a little bit ago. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Trisha Hersey's work at the Knapp Ministry, so there's this person, she identifies as the Knapp Bishop, and her whole thing is, you know, people need to rest. Rest is revolution. And there's a critique of that which says, you know, you can't self-care your way out of oppression. Like, people need resources. And so, like, as we're imagining this better future, as we're taking this time to imagine, how do we balance, and maybe balance isn't the right word, but how do we balance, like, the world that we're living in and need to continue to survive in with this imagined future?
I would say relationships, community. I think those are very key, because the first image I got, literally when you were talking, the first image, I don't know why, but the first image I got was like of a tree in the forest that is like passing down the information to those seedlings, to their roots, the root system. Mm. And like, they're passing out the information and saying, hey, in like 1861, between 1912, there was this infestation of this type of bug in this region. And I'm going to give you the information for if it happens again, you're able to deal with it. Or we had a horrible fire for this summer of drought. So I'm going to pass out the information to the little tiny seedling and try to understand like what these things. So I guess I'm sort of making the case for relationship with the past, present, and future. And I always look towards Afrofuturism as like a vessel of change, because I think when you start to look at things such as Afrofuturism or non-Western ways of thinking, like time is less like one direction, it's more circular. Like I don't know if I'm giving you your direct answer. I think that type of change needs to happen in relationship, but also wrestling with like, so I wrote a manifesto on the future. And one of the pillars in the manifesto on the future was like we have to actively mind and for new meaning. And we have to be able to break free from this hyper reality, this sort of simulation, this old model, this old narrative, this old symbolic structure that is very much like at this sort of, there's a meta thing. And then there's other truths that are happening and burgeoning in terms of these revolutions. But I feel like it's our responsibility to challenge our own thinking and grow. And I think it's, and I agree with the critique, like an hungry stomach is not gonna lend itself to like trying to like break free philosophically, spiritually, and culturally. But I do feel like that for me comes first. I think for me that has the highest priority, is like we have to be able to do the inner work, and we have to be able to, and I'm not talking about rest, I'm talking about like deconstructing our own narratives, deconstructing our own identities, questioning why we say the things that we do, and not just to accept the things because we're learning about them. And I think that's the biggest challenge, and that sort of robust intellectual curiosity or that imaginative space that kind of start to evolve, self-initiate, evolve our own meaning structures, I think is most important. Because I feel like no matter how much you feed people's bellies, like for me, I want to stop the cycles. I want to stop this cycle that we're thrusted upon in the West, or not necessarily stop it, transform it into something that's healthier and more sustainable. And that just makes more sense. And all of this it can never be universalized. I think it's going to have to come from, I feel I'm saying a lot, but I think the challenge of the 21st century is going to be like, how do we create a unified whole where diversity can exist and thrive? And I feel like you can't do that without diving into yourself. Like, I don't think a piece of bread, and I know that's going to be controversial, but I don't think a piece of bread I think it's important. Like, system change happen from bottom up, top down, middle out, and everyone needs to do the work. But I feel like for me as an artist, as a storyteller, I see the highest value, and I'm biased. I see the highest value in the mind, in our consciousness, in our meaning structures, and sort of breaking free from this colonized imagination that we are so embedded into.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're also saying this from a place of not like incredible scarcity, right? Where like you have bread in your stomach, you have a roof over your head. And, you know, most people who are listening to this podcast do, right? But there is still often like this sense of scarcity and urgency that comes with that. And this is a question for me, and I imagine other people are wondering too. As an entrepreneur, right, how have you embraced this restorative way of being, both in the pace of your work, the type of work that you do, and the relationships that you build within your work?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I extremely come from a space of privilege. And I think the idea of privilege is so complex. It's like, as a Black immigrant in the US, like learning the language, all of these different layers of things. And it's like, and then going into the education. And I think, yeah, I definitely recognize that. And I think for me, my fear of change is almost like I have to use the systems that I'm in to submerge the systems. It's like, I'm embedded in a system. I have power and privilege. So how do I use that to create new things? But to answer your question specifically, I think for me is like, I value deeply my mental health. I'm almost militant about it. And I was telling you before the podcast started, I did like a social media. I'm still in that social media detox of just not going on Instagram, not going on Facebook, not going on Twitter, just disconnecting, not even answering text messages. I put a post on my Facebook. I'm like, I'm sorry, everyone. I apologize. Like, I want to create works of art and I want to be able to like take care of my mental health. So I think for me, going to the gym and like working out this physical body, like meditation, 30 minutes a day, drinking a lot of water, eating greens or non-meat diet, vegetarian diet, listening to anything that I can to, like, I feel like I have to use every freaking tool that I have in my pocket to be able to heal myself and maintain this sort of mental health. Because like I said in the beginning, it's like there is constant pain. And I think in this journey of life now, for me, I feel like there is a responsibility that I have and using everything that I have understood and gained to be able to keep pushing forward. So I think I'm very militant around my mental health and protecting it and doing the things, because I know if I don't meditate or journal in the morning, something's going to be off. Like, I just know that. It's like, and that offness is going to make me maybe even more angrier to be able to have the empathy to someone that says something stupid that's against like my past or history. So it's like or even if I read something online. So I've been very more militant about my mental health. I think COVID has definitely brought that and has changed my dynamic. I just know I cannot think or imagine when I'm in a space of utter chaos and trauma. So I definitely recognize what you're saying, in that I do have a roof under my head and I do have bread in my stomach. And I think that it just adds even layers of click. Like, this is why I feel like it's even more important for me to, like, I need to be able to do what I need to do to be at my best so I can continue to do the work that I need to do.
Yeah. And like, I'm there with you on so many levels, except that, like, as many times as I have heard it, like being militant about like making that time for yourself, like, that's something that I've struggled with so much. And part of it, I know, is like, I'm about to be a parent for the first time. And like, even with that, like, I'm not like this person, this new person's only support in the world. Like, it's okay for me to like take time for myself and be David, not just David, the parent of like this new baby, right? You're not the first person. You're probably not the last person. From elders to peers who are like, you know, David, take care. And to the listener, I hope you're doing a better job at all of this than I am. But if you need to take a pause and like really answer for yourself, like, what are the things that I'm doing to make sure that I can be at my best for the communities, my people that I'm trying to build a world for. I think this is a worthy moment to do that. And then you can come back to the rest of this podcast when you are ready. You know, I've thought a lot about how the world will be for, you know, my baby, right? Who have yet to meet by the time this airs, probably we're talking about a month. And you talked about, you know, this idea of 2060. And maybe it was Jody who presented this question. But I want to ask you, you know, in 2060, the world, all is right with the world, right? We are in right relationship with each other. We are healing. We are in right relationship with the earth. What are the steps that we took to get there?
The first word that popped in my brain is self-awareness. I feel like revolutions are inherently like destructive, and they're very, very destructive, not only for the people, but from the from their societal level as well. And I think right now we're in midst like multiple revolutions that is changing the planet, either by force or by will or just emergent. Like we have like the internet that's connecting people extremely fast. We have 3D computers. We have like AI, artificial intelligence. We have a lot of like, we have climate change as well. A lot of people are just realizing like an economy based on coal and or sort of in a meat-based economy, a lot of these things are very destructive towards the environment. So I think there's just so much in terms of the change that is going to, that is changing us. And I always say that you need storytellers, you need artists to be able to craft like a cultural and artistic transformative renaissance. Something that is gonna be able to be held in by communities everywhere and communities of artists sort of coming together to reimagine what their cities are and where they came from as a people and what are the wounds and the harms that have been done from that time. And I feel like a lot of these things, yes, will need to be translated into policy making. And I think we do need to bridge the gap in terms of our policies and the science and bridging those two realities. I think we need new mythologies, new ways of understanding our mind, or like new ways of understanding everything, history, gender, culture, whiteness, blackness. And I feel like a lot of it is going to be dependent on magnifying like this sort of inner life that humanity, I feel, is frozen. I think I almost feel like there's an ice age, and the ice age is inside of us, and we're sort of frozen and we're kind of stuck in a certain way. So for me, this envisioning of 2060, where things are restored, things are good, things are happening, I think this is sort of like this gigantic force, cultural, artistic, media force that is just sort of awakening people and making them feel things they've never felt before, and ask questions that they've never asked before. And I don't necessarily believe that can be co-opted by capitalism or the top 1%, or I'm an optimist. So I know there's going to be a lot of people who are like, that's going to be never possible. But you asked me the question about what it would look like in 2060. But I do feel that, I don't know, I just think like the amount of change that I've been able to go through in terms of the healing and how much more that I need to go in terms of the current state of the world and what has worked for me. I choose to make the assumption that in humanity, that potential exists. And I think if every single person amidst this cultural transformative renaissance is pursuing their highest excitement, their curiosity, and what livens them up the most, what excites them the most, where they're able to choose. Like, for example, in the Caribbean Sky Island world, one of the writers created, Celeste Rita Baker, she's from the Virgin Islands, she brought up this idea of like planned exposure. where she's reimagining what the education system would look like, where a kid is not going in a classroom to learn, but what they do, all the kids across the Caribbean Sky Island worlds get scheduled in to do three weeks to a month apprenticeship, and to see different aspects of society. And if there's a spark in their eyes, then they can pursue that route and whatever field that might be. And I feel that's such a different way of looking at our certain model, where it's like our education system. So I think like our imagination needs to be just kind of blasted or up and down, and we need to bloom. Like we need to like deconstruct our imaginative structures. And I think we've seen that a lot in COVID. We've seen that a lot, but it wasn't necessarily a planned thing. COVID just sort of like made us pause, and everyone was branched into George Floyd when his neck was being squeezed out. Like everyone saw and realized what like these sort of post Obama age, post racial age was all a sort of narrative that was being fed in terms of just like not really dealing with what's under the table, the trauma collectively. 'Cause I think like as individuals, if we do because I think a lot of the problems on the planet is our mental patterns and belief system that are expressed systemically. Mm-hmm. Because I choose to believe in the inner life dictates, like, it's almost as if this Sigmund Freud that says, until you make the unconscious conscious, you call it fate. And I think there's a lot of forces in our world that is dictating so much of the way we live, and we just don't ask questions. So I think I want more empowered, more owned creators. Like Seth Godin says, we're all artists. I believe that too. Like I think it's very possible. I think it's extremely possible.
And I think there's a lot of benefit. I've just been like debating whether or not I'm going to name the movie, and I don't think I'm going to. There are a lot of movies. And it's a common thing to like, you know, use these doomsday scenarios, these doomsday scenarios to like try to inspire fear in people to make change, right? And like you can throw comedy on it, you can throw drama on top of it, but like people walk away from that and it's like, well, I guess this is hopeless, you know, right? And you know what you're talking about, imagining or building these portals for imagination into a better future is a much more optimistic, a much more hopeful, and hopefully a much more inspiring way to go than just saying like, this is what will happen if we keep doing things the way that they are.
You see, don't get me wrong. I do believe like genres such as dystopia or horror or any type of genre in terms of fiction stories, it's just, it has to be done well. I think most of them are not really done well. The world is not necessarily fleshed out. There's a lot of like continuity, there are plot holes and characterization. And it's just sort of, they're following this sort of meta prototype formula for like, okay, we need to invest this amount of money because we've done market research, or we had a previous asset from this brand and this franchise that created this narrative. So it's like they have a certain franchise, and that franchise has certain rules, and that rules is are necessarily very market driven, because we don't want to see, do you want to see Ash Ketchum? I'm using like a Japanese one, but like, or Batman, like is Batman a babysitter? No one's going to ever see Batman. I'm not saying Batman is going to be a babysitter, but it's like those narratives are almost like are set, and there are formulas to sort of the Hollywood way. And I think it's changing. It's transforming, but I do feel like we shouldn't I'm not saying we should discount dystopia. I think a good dystopia can definitely do a lot of just like, because I think all storytelling is like an ancient mythological device. It has information, it has data. I think I was reading somewhere where, I forgot the authors, but it was like a Paris Review interview with these Italian writers, and they were talking about how the novel is like the last imaginative space where you can include It has like great synthetic power. You can include history, philosophy, poetry, like essays. You can include so many different things, science, religion, and its power to transform the human being. You're kind of like sharing this mirror where people can engage. And I think film does the same thing, but a lot of it is not done well. or it's just not allowed to be, because it's like you saw this in the 90s as well, where the art film sort of movement, and then there's sort of a break between this sort of the, yeah, there's a whole history around like the independent film track and the more artsy film and why they're not like necessarily don't really resonate. But I think it's changing. I do believe it's changing. And what all I'm saying is just the other genres, if it's done well, I think the impact can be astounding.
Yeah. And like, again, not naming the movie, but like when I was thinking about this one or this genre specifically, it's like that's still rooted in like the white male gaze and patriarchy and white supremacy. And so like, it's like, of course, this is the way that things are going to go. And so, yeah, to think about other, when things are done well, when things are being told by more, I hate using this word, but like more inclusive, with a more inclusive lens, like it can definitely be that kind of transformative and inspirational or thought-provoking thing as well.
100%. I wanted to add this question, this comment, because I feel like that's a lot of what we're doing at Syllable. And it's like, I feel like a lot of the challenge has been like, yeah, you have three white guys creating a black woman character, for example. And I know there's a whole movement to diversify the writer's room, or even in publishing, the publishing industry, get more diverse perspective. I feel like the more you're able to imagine within local rooted context from the people, by the people, I feel like the stories are going to have a more universal like taste to them. And I think a lot of people are afraid to do that because they just kind of maintain on their own communities and on their own processes.
For sure. Yeah. This doesn't need to turn into like a representation in media podcast, but like there's so many trails, so many things that I'm thinking about. You've left us with a lot. I want to make sure that we have time for the questions that everybody answers. So in your own words, restorative justice is?
Is coming to self.
I like that. As you've been doing this work over the years and, you know, this work, quote unquote, this restorative justice way of being, what has been like an oh shit moment or like a mistake? And what did you learn from it?
I think not overreacting. Just like overreacting and just simply knowing that like our entire, the model of our society, like white supremacy is very real. And it's subtle and it's alive, and I need to be patient as well. I don't know if that answers that question, but
is there a specific type of overreaction that like are you talking about like catastrophizing, like this is the most important thing at this moment, and so like there's this like immense sense of urgency, and so I'm going to drop everything, and like if this doesn't get taken care of now, the world is over? Or is it something else?
I think it's more like the Buddha says, it's like being angry at someone is like holding your hot coal. It's like this sort of overreaction, this anger, or this sort of like pain that is felt, and how that pain sort of guides us like marionettes. And we're sort of pulled into a direction that we think we have control, but it's sort of the fight or flight mentality where like the amygdala is like open when we're like in this fight or flight, when we're like shocked. So I think just being aware of that and being patient and knowing that, yeah, the world is fucked up. Like this is going to happen. I am going to be triggered. I am going to be this. I'm going to do that. So I think being patient with myself, I would say that in that context.
One of my favorites. You get to sit in circle with four people, living or dead. Who are they? And what is the question you ask the circle?
My God, this is an intense question. The first person that popped to my brain was Toussaint Louverture, which was one of the founding the forefathers of Haiti. Mm-hmm. I would bring in Nietzsche as well. Nietzsche would be there, Friedrich Nietzsche. I would also bring, I would say Audre Lorde would be in there, and James Baldwin.
And what is the question you ask that circle?
I don't know. Like, I would ask, like, what does revolution mean to you? And what does revolution mean? And I think they all came at it from such a unique lens. Like Nietzsche came at it from the self-empowerment. Like Audre was all about social justice and the body and like the erotic and this sort of the pleasure activism that Adrienne Marie Brown talks a lot about. James Baldwin, just one of the greatest writers ever lived, in a way he's sort of prophetic in his word. And then Toussaint, who was like born a slave and found his freedom and then started to like just really just use diplomacy to and just tactics to be able to navigate a like French colonial era. So I just feel like all of these, I don't know, it will be interesting. There are so many different people, but that's a really great question to ask.
Yeah. Very interesting. And the beautiful part about that is I get to now turn that question back to you. What is revolution, Fabrice?
There's this quote by Voltaire, and he says, like, there's one thing that is more powerful than all of the greatest armies on the planet, all of the greatest warships, guns, militaries. And he says, it's an idea whose time has come. And I feel like for me, revolution at the most fundamental space is it's almost as if it's like, the metaphor that I see is like a tree with mangoes. And there's mangoes that if you take the green mango, put it in a box, put it in a corner, it's going to be ripe. And then you're going to taste it. It's going to be super sweet. But there are mangoes, and most mangoes, if you leave it to the point where it's the ripest and it falls right on your hand and you eat it, it's going to be the sweetest mango. So I feel like for every single person that is living on the planet, there is an idea or a way of thinking or a narrative or a story that can unlock this sort of in this revolution of values that MLK talks about, this sort of evolving or psychic, like, or psychological, emotional, spiritual landscape that has been so trapped by this sort of imaginary construct of our planet currently. So I feel like revolution for me is like, what is that idea that you, David, is going to propel you towards more of your humanity? And I think we all have one. Even if your belly is starving, even if you're at war, I think there is those ideas. I seek them every day. Like, what is my aha moment that's going to change the way I think? I would say that's revolution. Because I think, again, my belief system is that a lot of the way the model currently works is our individual thought patterns are expressed systemically on a broader collective sense around the planet. It's the body. I think we're living in the age of the butterfly effect, where the killing of Michael Brown is a death for every single Black person on the planet. The man that like burned himself alive in Tunisia, like that impacted the entire planet. Like the oceans rising in the Comoros Islands, where 200,000 people are pushed out. Like all of this impacts. Like it's just, I think we're living in an age of butterfly effect, and we need to realize that as an individual, we have more agency than we're told in terms of changing. But it's going to come with a lot of sacrifice and a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of self-care.
As I was listening to you, I was getting a little bit fearful, because like you were saying, like, yes, everybody has this revolutionary idea. And I was like, yes, and a lot of those revolutionary ideas I do not agree with, right? Mm. But when you tagged on, like, that will lead you to your greatest humanity, I still think there's some people whose ideas of their greatest humanity that, like, I'm not going to agree with and be very vehemently against. But I think, like, the call to call people into their greatest humanity is something that's so worthy of people you know, taking the time to think about, like, what is that for you? I mean, for me, in many ways, it is quote unquote restorative justice. But, you know, those are just words to represent this idea of, like you were talking about, interconnection, and how do we treat each other accordingly, knowing that, you know, what you do has an impact on me and what I do has an impact on you because we're a part of each other. That kind of, and that might fulfill the response to this question, but I often ask as well, what's one thing, mantra, an affirmation, or something that you want everyone listening to this podcast to know?
No, I just pulled up the future manifesto that I mentioned earlier, and I kind of sort of hinted at one of the pillars, and the number five pillars, I think that could be the one that I would say is we are all storytellers. We must actively mine new meaning that warms up in us and in others our natural inclination for beauty, care for the planet, curiosity, affection, friendship, and creativity. So I think all of these are in us, and I think we have to cultivate them despite when the world tells us it's not possible. Don't let cynicism win. There is a cynic inside of me for sure, but it's there in community. It's this inner Congress in my inner life. It's just a voice that allows me more information. But I do feel like everyone is at the edge of their new humanity or becoming more human and embracing those sort of values. We all have that, I feel. Those ideas are out there. They're floating somewhere around. It's just like, it's so chaotic right now.
That's beautiful. I have two more questions.
Yeah.
This is where Jody invited me to talk to you. So who's one person that I should have on this podcast? And you got to help me link up.
Absolutely. I feel like the first people that that popped in my brain is Bree and Sam. And I think I had them on my podcast, and they're absolutely phenomenal individuals. And they founded Delicious Democracy. And their entire vision is, how do we make democracy more playful and delicious? And how do we bring creativity to sort of political structure and a level of play to our, like, the political process? So they're both activists. And I feel like, yeah, they would be really great people. They're doing really great work in terms of, like, their vision of equitism that they're working on. So I would recommend them. They're pretty good.
One, I'll be looking forward to that introductory DM or email. Probably email, because you're off the DMs right now. Beautiful. Well, then we've come to the very end, where the last question is, how and where can people support you and your work in the ways that you want to be supported?
Yeah, absolutely. So I see myself as, like, I do a lot in terms of less, like, I feel like I can't be put in a box. So, like, I write a lot of science fiction and fantasy as well. So you can check out my writings. I'm also a columnist for this newspaper called Haiti Observateur. So a lot of the issues that I wrestle with is around, how do I say, Haiti in the future, and kind of looking at these systems and this in the future in the face of what's happening in Haiti, and trying to tie those things. So I have some of the articles I've written on my website. I also would recommend check out my music as well. I'm a musician, singer, songwriter, and I just released an EP called Reach. And a lot of it is just sort of trying to lean more into, like, Haitian futurism, Afrofuturism. It's an acoustic take around these things. And yeah, and I think a lot of what I mentioned earlier, I'm a podcaster as well. So a lot of my podcast focuses on the future of humanity and trying to bring people on and see their visions for the future. Because I think the next 30 years, like you said, in 2060, is going to be, like, this is the greatest opportunity. We're living in the greatest opportunity to reinvent the planet completely new. Like, I think it's possible. Like, literally, I really believe in this. We're the age of the butterfly. And I think those changes are very possible. So I think you can support me in many ways and take your time with a lot of the content, because I definitely go, like, and express myself fully in those processes. But if you go to FABRICE.com GUERRIER.com, and you'll find all my portfolio of my projects and stuff. And you can also check out Syllable and some of the work that we do there with the writers and some of the upcoming collaborations we have. And if you're a writer, I'm just going to do this plug in. If you're a writer, we have this event called Pens Down, where we pick a world, and for an hour on a Saturday, we write for a flash story in that world together for an hour, and we debrief. And you have also access to supportive community. You also have the opportunity potentially getting published. So yeah, definitely link up with me. I am online, and I definitely have been off the grid for the last month or two. So, and I do plan to be more off the grid, just trying to disconnect and trying to find my inner world. But yeah, this was amazing, David. Seriously, I appreciate the work that you do. And I think restorative justice is something that has changed my life. It's just a different way of looking at the world. And this sort of, as a philosophy, as a movement, I think it has an incredible potential to just kind of restore. I don't think restorative justice is a panacea. And I think you mentioned that earlier too. We shouldn't like embrace it as a panacea, because it's like, you have to be able to, it creates space for other things to rise, which I think that is such the power of it. So I appreciate what you're doing. So thank you again for having this space and letting and bringing all those stories out of me. So this is epic.
Yeah, I truly, truly loved it. We'll have all of those things linked for folks in the show notes, so you know how to engage with Fabrice's music, the writing, the community podcast, all of it. Any other words that you want to leave the people with?
No, just I feel like, I know that times are very dark, and the media shows us that the world is in dismay and destruction, but I feel like holding on, and I know it's hard to, it's big to ask people that, the optimism, but I feel like doing everything possible to embrace this sort of, this optimism, and I think it starts with mental health and being able to take action towards that, like attack it. Defend yourself from your attack thoughts that are attacking you, attacks all of us every day. That would be my last thing. I think it's possible. It's very possible.
Beautiful. Well, until next time, it has been a pleasure. So glad to get to connect with you and meet you. Everybody else, I hope you've deeply enjoyed this, and we'll be back with another wonderful conversation about this restorative justice life next week.
Hey folks, Elise here. Thank you so much to Fabrice for all that you had to offer this episode. I think that Fabrice brought up some really important points that restorative justice thrives on imagination and creativity. He actually said, "I believe that our planet will be saved by creativity." It is sometimes really difficult to have this positive outlook, but if we do choose to become more optimistic about our future, we can help manifest that future. Creativity is often stifled in our systems, especially when it comes to white supremacy culture. White supremacy culture prioritizes urgency and the lack of patience, and it also prioritizes hierarchical structures that make it really difficult for people to feel empowered and for people to feel like they can be creative and that their ideas will be heard and listened to. In order to cultivate creativity, we have to dismantle white supremacy culture. Also, we can do that by using our imagination to imagine a better world and to imagine creative solutions. Also, Fabrice brought up the point, what does revolution mean to you? Now, we often turn these questions back onto the guests, but I want to turn the question onto our listeners. What does revolution mean to you? Revolutions thrive upon creative thinking, and I think that we can even broaden our definition of a revolution. You can be revolutionary every single day if you want to be, if you are breaking down barriers. That is revolutionary. You can be revolutionary. And I think that if we broaden those definitions, we can also broaden our landscape and broaden our thought in order to be creative and seek creative solutions. As always, thank you so much for tuning into this episode today. And if you want to stay connected, make sure to check out all the links in the show notes below, where you can hear more from Amplify Restorative Justice and from Fabrice. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. Or if you're old school, tell a friend. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, signing up for a community gathering, workshop, or course. So many options. Links to everything in the show notes. Or on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.